Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with my special guest appearances from my cat Chicken, probably, and potentially the wild parrots next door. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. Today, I'm very excited to have a repeat guest. This is writer, director, actor, Bria Grant. Hi!
Hi! Thanks for having me on as a repeat guest. I was really excited when I got the invite.
It was just like, you know, it's been a while. You've done a lot of stuff. We might as well have her back on. You know, people love the basket case episode. And, you know, if you guys haven't listened to that one yet, definitely go back to listen to basket case. And it's nice when, you know, we've got someone who's got kind of a depth of knowledge about horror to come and pick maybe lesser known classics. For those of you who are not as familiar with Bria's work, please let me give another introduction. So Bria Grant is a native Texan who earned a degree in American Studies before venturing into acting. Early in her career, she appeared in Friday Night Lights before heading west to LA for roles on shows such as Heroes and Dexter. Then she stepped behind the screen, co-writing and directing and starring in the film Best Friends Forever. That film follows a tense friendship brought to its knees on a road trip when a nuclear disaster approaches. From there, Bria became a producer actor on the Emmy-nominated Netflix series Eastsiders. But you can see her in a bunch of films too, like Beyond the Gate, All the Creatures Were Stirring, After Midnight, and many more. But the new ones to look out for are Lucky and 12 Hour Shift, both official selections of South by Southwest and Fantasia Film Festival this year. Lucky, written by and starring Bria, is a pitch black comedy or horror satire about a woman terrorized by a stalker, and nobody seems to care. Though Bria doesn't act in 12 Hour Shift, really, she did write and direct this tight and bloody horror about a junkie nurse just trying to sell body parts on the black market when her life blows up on one epic shift. She'll also star in upcoming films Happily, The Stylist, and Night Sky. On top of that, Bria is also the co-host of the Maximum Fun podcast, Reading Glasses. So a lot of things going on, and you just told me you went to Bulgaria and got a haircut.
I got a haircut. To get a haircut in quarantine, you have to fly to Bulgaria.
No. She was working on a TV show.
Yeah.
So there's always your IMDb list is forever expanding. Bria, the movie that you chose to talk about today is May. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Yeah, well, when y'all reached out, I was trying to think of one because the last one I chose, I feel like, was so silly. I was like, what is a little bit one with a that's a little bit more serious? Although, I mean, I do think it is very quirky and funny as well. But
oh, there's a silliness to
it. There's definitely a silliness to it. But I hadn't seen it in a few years until I rewatched it. But the star of May is Angela Bettis, who is the star of 12 Hour Shift, which I wrote and directed and will be out in October. And it was a movie that really inspired me. I think around the time when I saw it, it was that time. It was a time in my life where I realized there was such a thing as independent movies. Like, I wasn't aware that was a thing before I saw it. It was like that. But I'm a Cheerleader, 13. Like, there were a couple of other like little independent movies that my friends and I saw, and I was like, wait, you can make movies that are weird like this? Like, I had no idea, and it kind of like blew my mind, and it's kind of always stuck with me. And working with Angela was just such a dream, and so I thought I just wanted to give this a little more love, you know?
Can I say that I almost see your film 12 Hour Shift is like a spiritual sequel to May? Because essentially, there's a woman collecting body parts. Yes.
You're not wrong. And I am very honored you said that. I also think, well, it's funny because in May, Angela has this like really big shift in her character, right? Like, the character of May goes from this like quirky, like unsure of herself woman to this very self-assured kind of woman on a mission to get these body parts. And that's kind of who she is a little bit in 12 Hour Shift in some ways, the second character in May.
Yeah. So it's like a revisiting of the themes with a little bit more maturity from her and her character.
Yeah.
I like to think that this is May down the road. But for those of you who haven't seen May, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch May first, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce May with a quick synopsis. Written and directed by Lucky McKee for release in 2002, May stars Angela Bettis as a maladjusted veterinarian assistant, trying to make friends and explore her sexuality. But we don't meet May as an adult yet. First, we get some backstory with a young May with a lazy eye, ridiculed by her peers. Her mother presents her with a doll named Susie encased in glass and tells her that if she can't find a friend, she should make one.
Her name is Susie. Susie was the first doll I ever made. She was my best friend, and now she'll be yours.
Now we're with adult May, whose lazy eye gets corrected with some contact lenses and glasses. One day, May meets Adam, played by Jeremy Sisto, a hunky mechanic and horror filmmaker. She's wildly naive, but he's kind of into it, and she's really into his beautiful hands.
I like every part of him, especially his hands. They're beautiful.
May's flirty coworker Polly, played by Anna Faris, then points her affections towards May. Surprise! Polly gives May a cat, and May's like, okay, sure.
Oh, come on. Look, you keep you company when you're all alone. Besides, she'll remind you of me. Okay. Wonderful.
Adam shows May one of his shorts depicting a lusty couple engaging in cannibalism, and May's so inexperienced that she gets inspiration from it and bites Adam's lip. He bleeds all over her, freaks out, and leaves.
I'll see you around.
But it's just like your movie.
May, this is weird.
You like weird?
Not that weird.
May yells at Susie, blaming her for her problems. Then, she starts volunteering with some blind children. Hey, might as well give back.
I saw some kids playing in the park, and I was wondering if I could volunteer to help watch them.
Well, what kind of kids were they? Retarded, deaf, crippled, dumb?
They were blind?
So you want to work at the daycare center?
Would it be the same kids?
What's the difference? You only like a certain type of blind kids?
She gives in to Polly's advances eventually when Adam ghosts her. But then when she seeks solace in Polly, Polly is already with another woman, Ambrosia.
Oh, May. Look, I can kick her out if you really want me to. You know you're my main mama.
May just wants one person she can own emotionally, goddammit. And when even the cat shuns her, May throws an ashtray at it and kills it. Then Susie really starts talking to May.
Shut up!
Next day, May brings Susie in to talk to the blind children, but her favorite, difficult student, Petey, gets too grabby and breaks the case and the doll, and then all the blind children crawl through the glass, and it's bloody and bad. This is the big psychotic break for her and potentially for some of these children. The next day, she meets a young punk whom she takes home and kills to harvest parts of his body. She's going to make her own friend, and she's going to need more parts. So she gets dolled up for Halloween and visits Polly. She's got to get that beautiful head of hers. She kills Polly, then kills Ambrosia for those beautiful gams.
You have really beautiful legs. I thought they were gams.
Then she takes off to Adam's and gets those beautiful hands. At home, she's constructed a human doll from the parts, but she freaks when she realizes the doll can't see her.
Can't see me.
So she carves out her own eye, gives it to the doll, and then lies down beside it. And miraculously, it comes to life and strokes May's hair. May finally made a friend. Okay.
That was good synopsis. That was good.
So that's May. So I want to talk about some of the things that Lucky was doing in this. I listened to the commentary. If you have not listened to the commentaries of May, they are incredible and confusing. And because everyone's kind of talking all at once.
Oh my
and
God.
There's two different versions. The first one has Lucky McKee, Brett Roberts, Steve Yedlin, who shot it, Angela Bettis, and then the actress who played Ambrosia. The second one has a quote-unquote craft services guy that, like, it's clearly not someone in craft services, or it's just like potentially Lucky McKee with playing with a different voice. I can't tell. And then also Ryan Johnson, who was one of the many editors who worked on this. So there was two different commentary tracks.
Right.
Highly recommend them. They're very informative of how things happen. But let's go into some of the techniques that he's using. So one of the problems that you get with films when you have like a flashback is that, you know, you kind of have to decide how much to give away, how much is too much, how much is too much leading, you know, like, are people going to like get the light bulb on the second that you say something? With this movie, you're just like, okay, well, she gives the doll and she's like, you need to make a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's enough kind of like seed planted that later on you might be able to figure it out. And I should preface this. The quotes that I'm going to say are mostly kind of combinations of all four of those people that are on that commentary. So it's not just Lucky McKee. It's a bunch of people. But they said, quote, "We cut about 30 different versions of the childhood sequence, and most of these were much longer than this. We cut out an entire sequence where Mae shoots this bird with a BB gun and takes it home, cuts its wings off, glues them to Susie's case, and tries to make her fly. It seemed a little extraneous and gave away the rest of what was going to happen in the film, so we ended up chopping it," end quote. And, you know, that's probably something that you have to grapple with, is like how much to front load your film with.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think that was a good move for them to cut that because it does give away the movie. You know what's interesting? I am not a huge fan of flashbacks. And I feel like it is a note that sometimes you get. I know you feel that, like, as a writer, people will be like, what if you did a flashback to like explain this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always like, no flashbacks, no voiceovers. Like, I'm very fussy about it. But I feel like this movie does a really good job. And you do sort of need it to know that she's going to go darker than just like your average 90s quirky girl. Early 2000s quirky mm-hmm. girl.
Yeah, it's not going to be like she's all that, you know?
Right. She's not going to take down her hair.
Her eyes corrected and all of a sudden.
And then go to the dance with like the perfect guy. No, she's really weird. She's actually like, she's more than weird. She's a sociopath. Like, she has some actual issues.
Yeah, deeply disturbed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think if I saw this now in a script, I'd be like, oh, that's a little... that's been done, but it's because the movies like this, the like overbearing parents or the parents that kind of say the wrong thing or don't really care about her. And I feel like it was a really good explanation for where she ended up.
So going in with kind of front loading things, something that ended up happening was they got this movie into Sundance. And at that point in time, they had to do a lot of reshoots. And one of the things that they had to reshoot is because in the structure of the story, we have the short flashback and then we go into, the present day of Mae being, you know, like a young 20 something. And she kind of does a monologue here. And that was all a reshoot because they realized that they actually had to get, like, they had to pull back from the childhood thing, from the metaphor stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But then they had to get more explicit with just kind of saying what the story was about. And it kept being like a push and pull, I think, from how much they had to give away. Because they said, quote, "Most of the stuff from the beginning is reshoots, all done after we got into Sundance. It was a monologue written on the fly. Sometimes 2 minutes before shooting, we would do that. All this may seem a little overstated on repeat viewing, but it makes it very clear off the bat what the story is about, which we always had a problem with," end quote. And I think that that's like an interesting thing of, there have been some scripts that I've worked on where I know that like I'm trying to be all fancy and tricky about like what something is. And then someone will give a note, which is like, oh, she could just say that that's what it is. And then like, you all of a sudden you get to cut out 20 fucking pages
because
you're like, what?
Yeah. Like, you're just like, right. She literally just tells you. It's so weird that we're talking about this because I keep having flashes to The Stylist, which is this movie that is premiering at Fantastic Fest that I did earlier this year that Jill Six directed. There is a real, that is a very spiritual sequel because The Stylist has a lot of the main girl who's played by Najara Townsend. Has a lot of May qualities. And it was something I know they thought about a lot in that script, is it, should they have flashbacks? Should they say more at the top? But instead, they just have her like kill someone right away. And that kind of, so then you're like, oh, we get it. We know who this lady is. Like, but you kind of do need that in the first few minutes, especially these days, I think you have to explain everything to people kind of early or else no one's going to keep watching your movie.
It's such a bummer. It is. I mean, sometimes it can make it easier, but it is such a bummer. When you were working on Lucky, I'm very curious because that actually, I think, follows those same rules mm-hmm. where like you really set out beforehand that like this is not a world that most people are familiar with. Like it's a cartoonish version of our world. Did you always arrive at that tone right in the beginning of the movie?
Yeah, actually. So the thing I would do when pitching Lucky is I would tell people about the scene where they explain everything, which is about 10, 15 minutes in, is that the guy shows up at the house and this was literally my pitch for it, is I'd be like, this woman wakes up and there's a guy like a stalker in her house or coming to her house, and her husband gets out of bed and he's like, yeah, of course he's here. That's this guy who comes to try to kill us every night. Get out of bed. We have to go fight for our lives now. And that was always my pitch because people either understood it from that point or they didn't understand it. And I was like, this is the movie. It's very weird. We're in a bizarro world and here's the explanation.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about May and also Lucky and 12 Hour Shift and all these other things that Bree's doing. We'll be right back. Hey there. I wanted to take a moment to give a little recommendation. A friend of the network and Max Fun pin designer, Megan Lynn Cott, has a new book coming out. It's called Unfamiliar Familiars, Extraordinary Animal Companions for the Modern Witch. Unfamiliar Familiars is a fun encyclopedic guide to finding and caring for your unconventional magical animal. So, I'm sure you guys are wondering, but I took the test. There's a lot of brackets involved and very, very highly scientific thing that Megan Lynn Cott has to sign. So you can find your familiar. And mine is an axolotl because, of course, I get along with fire signs. I love Leos. I'm also cold-blooded. But, you know, if you get this book, you can also take your own quiz here and find out who your familiar is. It's a great gift for a lot of your single friends, I'm going to say, too. It's available wherever books are sold. But if you order through chroniclebooks.com, Maximum Fun listeners will get 30% off with the promo code FAMILIARS through December. So find out more about the book and take a fun quiz determining who your familiar is today at chroniclebooks.com/familiar.
Hi, I'm Allie Gertz.
And I'm Julia Prescott, and we host Round Springfield.
Round Springfield is a Simpsons adjacent podcast where we talk to your favorite Simpsons writers, voice actors, and everyone who's worked on the show to talk about shows that aren't The Simpsons. So we're going to be talking to people like David X. Cohen, Yeardley Smith, Tim Long about other projects they've worked on, sometimes projects that didn't go well, some failures, some rejection,
some failed pilots, some failed life events.
Yeah, we just talked to all the failures of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
So if you really love your Simpsons trivia and want to get to know the people who have worked on The Simpsons a little bit better, come by Round Springfield.
Every other week on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Bria Grant, and we're talking about May. So, you know, we were talking a little bit about those like low budget tricks that you can use in film. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting when we were talking, when Steve Yedlin was talking about cinematography in that commentary, was that they had little tricks to do movement, to have more movement within the frame without having to set up, for instance, tracks to do like long tracking shots or something. They said, quote, "The first shot we shot was the nipple shot when May's walking down the street." For those who haven't seen it, she's got pretty prominent nipples out when she's walking down the street. Anyway, and a couple of these shots are done with the sliders, basically a plate that goes on top of the dolly head and gives you about 2 feet you can slide the camera from left to right without setting up the tracks. When I saw the dailies for this scene, I knew the movie would be great, end quote. Hmm. And I think that that's a really lovely thing that I did not notice whatsoever when I was watching it the first time. And after the commentary, I was just like, actually, the camera is not moving that much, but it's moving enough to kind of give this dynamic energy that elevates it out of a kind of low budget indie and into something that has kind of production value that we would say, quote unquote. But that's something that you're always fighting. Like, you don't have time to lay down tracks to do these things all the time.
Right. And especially because they probably didn't own that street. They probably, like, were shooting it, you know, and had to, like, stop people from walking down the street but couldn't actually block off the street itself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that is a really efficient way. And, I mean, as an indie filmmaker, you always know you're trying to, like, do things like that. For 12-hour shift, I wanted a lot of movement in the movie because it's so, like, active and frenetic, and, like, I wanted a lot of things happening, but we couldn't afford a dolly, so my producers built a fake dolly for us to use when we're walking down the hall, because we go back and forth down this hall so many times. Literally went to Home Depot, got a bunch of wheels, put it on a cart, and, like, made it, put a little cushion on there for the DP to hold the camera. Because that we just mm-hmm. knew we would need it so much, and it was such a good move. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not, like, completely steady and there were problems with sound because the wheels, yes. But for us, it was a lifesaver for us.
I mean, no one's going to see that behind the scene unless you've got, like, a BTS photographer who's just like, oh, this is what they were doing.
Right.
Other than that, it's just kind of movie magic, you know? Like, it's just, if it shows up on screen, it doesn't matter how you were able to do it.
Totally. And I think also, like, there is, like, you know, a bit of indie pride in, like, being like, no, we're a little scrappy and that's okay. Like, we know how much money we have and that doesn't bother us. Like, we went into mm-hmm. it knowing we couldn't afford a dolly. That's okay.
So one of the things that I know you wanted to talk about was the film within a film.
Oh my God, we must.
And okay, because Jeremy Sisto's character is kind of like a burgeoning horror auteur, and he's got this little film that he shows May. And I don't remember who actually made that film, but it wasn't Lucky and Steve Yedlin. It was someone else who came back and made that film and they put it in. Like,
okay,
they gave them instructions of, like, what they wanted them to do, and then came back and they were like, oh shit, yeah, this is great.
Oh my God. Yes. Well, watching that scene this time around, it's been a long time. Like, I haven't watched this movie since I have been a filmmaker. So it's been over 10 years since I've watched this movie. And watching mm-hmm. it, I just had this moment of mini flashbacks to dates with horror directors and being at their houses and having to sit through their shitty short films. And then also moments of, like, I've made people do this for me, watching my stuff. And then I was like, oh my God, this is, like, so embarrassing. But it comes from such a place where I was just like, oh, Lucky kind of gets it. He gets it, right? Like, because mm-hmm. he's obviously been in these situations where you have to watch someone's short film. And I guess May gives the reaction that we're all really looking for, where she's just, like, not sure. And then she, at the end, she's basically like, brilliant. It's brilliant. Like, she loved it so much that she wants to have sex with him and try to bite off his fingers.
I want to move on to the actor who can nail a monologue in a single take, because that apparently was Angela Bettis on this set. There is a scene where the two of them, May and Jeremy Sisto's character, are sitting on the bench. And she's kind of talking to him, doing this kind of monologue, and he's just sitting there listening to him and listening to her in the park. And apparently they only did two takes, and it was both perfect, both takes, because the one take was a wide, you know, you get that wide, and then there's a beautiful close up of Angela Bettis. And so she did one of each of those, nailed both of them, and that's what they used to cut. They didn't have time, they didn't do anything else, but, like, they needed her to nail it, and which is, you know, amazing, because, you know, a lot of those lines, I think they said that they kept kind of rewriting until, like, the day, and so she was just constantly getting, like, new pages of what she had to do. And I was curious if you could talk about that from both an actor's perspective and a director's perspective.
Yeah, well, I will say, like, nothing about that surprises me, having worked with her, because she comes in very, very prepared, but you can also throw anything at her and she can handle it. I cannot overstate how wonderful she is to work with, like, watching her and all the subtlety she has and all of the, she just has, like, she's so good at what she does, and she has such specificity with everything she does, and, that doesn't surprise me at all. And then on 12-hour shift, we would always do an improv take on every setup. And she was also great at that, which is this crazy thing. It's unfortunate for her because it means she gets less takes than everybody else. Because I'm like, well, you nailed it on the first one, so I don't know what to tell you. But it's amazing as a director because she comes in just like giving you everything you could possibly want. But yeah, monologues are hard. I have this monologue in After Midnight. Did you see After Midnight? Have you seen that? Yeah.
It's on Amazon Prime for people who want to watch
it. Oh, it is. Okay, cool. I have this monologue in After Midnight that's, I think it's it doesn't cut and it's like 12 or 13 minutes or something like that. And I did not nail that on the first take. We did about 11 takes. I did get it most of the way through every time, but it was more like I wasn't happy with my performance most of the time and or they weren't happy or something didn't work. We would do it again and again. So we just, this whole night, we did this 12-minute take over and over again. It's something like that. Jeremy's going to be mad that I can't remember the exact number of minutes. but it's hard because, you know, when you start acting, that's actually what you do is you learn a lot of monologues and you do these monologues in class. And that's a horrible idea because you rarely actually ever do them in actual filmmaking at all. Like, you don't do monologues. People don't often write monologues for actors in films because they can be boring and easily screwed up.
Yes.
yes. And a lot of times, as you know, I'm sure, you end up cutting some of them. Like, someone has a really long speech and then you cut like halfway through because you're like, ugh, this movie's not flowing well enough. But then, so you work out how to like do a monologue and beginning acting. And then by the time you get to the set and actually get to do one, you've kind of forgotten all about how to do it. But the thing they always tell you is to pretend like you're talking to someone and they're like responding and you're keeping on going and stuff, which kind of works. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it's just a skill set that I feel like you learn from years of doing crap.
There's something that was really interesting that Lucky was saying in the commentary about working with her and how to kind of arrive at this persona and this performance. And I kind of speaks into what you're saying. But he said, quote, "When we started out rehearsing for the part, me and Angela, she was doing so much stuff with her face. She'd create a moment out of every single word. The big solution was to tell her to do absolutely nothing and then build up from there. Mm-hmm. I couldn't figure out how to work with all the stuff she was doing. So I had her performing like a robot for a while and we layered in the character from there. An amazing experience," end quote. So I think, you know, he was a somewhat inexperienced director coming up with an actor who's doing a lot. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you want something? I'm going to give you everything. And I think that's an interesting way to kind of build up a character, is just to say like, okay, as an actor, I love what you're doing. And like, let's set all of that aside and like see what pieces we can use and what pieces we don't need to use. But he's right. Her face is amazing. She is making a moment out of every single word.
Yes. And a lot of the moment she does all this stuff that is very funny in May, where I'm like, that was definitely like not written into the script. She's just like, her reaction or her moment when someone does something that she doesn't like or when she's deciding something, it's all written on her face in a way that actually makes the movie more of a comedy to me. Because she is of such a really, her timing is really good and she's such a really funny person, that it totally plays for me. Yeah, all on her face. I like that note from Lucky, though. That's interesting. And I've definitely done the same with actors that I've worked with. And as an actress, had the same done to me. When I was on Heroes, a DP actually took me aside at one point and he had recorded me and he was like, "I'm just going to show you something. Your face is this big on the screen. Your face takes up all of the screen. You don't have to move. We see everything." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And it like changed my acting. And it was just this DP that, like, you know, it wasn't even his place to probably tell me that information, but it was so helpful. And I have said the same thing to actors. Anytime I direct that, I'm like, "Oh, you're doing a lot, but you know what? We pick up everything. The camera loves to pick stuff up. So don't worry about it. And if you're not doing enough, I will definitely tell you."
So I'm going to go to the other side of things. We should talk about Jeremy Sisto for a second, because I think it's interesting. Something that they point out in the commentary is that he's playing essentially what would be normally the girlfriend part in a movie. They said, quote, "That was the first time Angela and Jeremy had acted together. It was me and them upstairs and me videotaping them together. And we did a couple of scenes. I was so blown away by Angie that I may not have given Jeremy the proper attention. His character is about reaction. He's playing the girlfriend part in this movie, the part women usually audition for. And it was harder to find the right guy for that part. Maybe some ego involved. He didn't have ego. He let her do her thing, which is important, to let the audience fall in love with her. He just reacted off of her," end quote.
Hmm.
And it gives me more appreciation for Jeremy Sisto, who I already love.
Yeah.
He's like such a charismatic person on screen.
Yeah, that's really interesting and not something I'd ever thought of. Although he does, like, we do kind of know some stuff about him. My note for people when I'm reading their scripts and I feel like there is a girlfriend-y character, I'm always like, what is her job? Does she have a job? Because if you can name her job, then I think she's not a girlfriend-y character. Just because I feel like I've played so many characters on screen that it's not clear how I make money, how I got anywhere. Like, it's just like, what is she doing here? I clearly am just there in service of the characters. I won't name what movie, but there is a movie that I'm in. Maybe I said this last time I was on your show, but I'm with the two main guys in the movie and we're walking from one room to another room. I am suddenly gone. My character actually disappears and the two guys keep walking and talking. It's never explained where I go and no one has ever brought it up to me. Because I was such a throwaway character. It just like didn't matter.
Holy shit.
It's very funny.
I mean, that's wild, but that is essentially what I think a lot of women have to get used to if they want to act. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get a little bit further into May and Bria's work. We'll be right back.
Have a lot of problems.
How do you juggle your holds at the library?
Well, how do you decide what to read next?
What do you do when you find out an author you love is a huge trash baby?
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
And we're the hosts of Reading Glasses.
We're here to solve all your reader problems and along the way, help you figure out
your reader wheelhouse,
which are the things that will absolutely make you pick up a book. Our listener favorites tend to be magic and a woman on a journey.
And also birds for some reason.
Your reader doghouse.
Yeah, that's the things that'll make you avoid a book.
Ugh, love triangles stress me out so much. Reading Glasses.
Every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, joined today by Bria Grant, and we are talking about May. The editing process for this film seemed very arduous. It was a lot of stuff that they had to do, like the reshoots. And of course, that is that way for any film. But I think with this one, it seemed like Lucky was still trying to develop his own style of what you wanted to do. And so like finding that voice in the post-production maybe was part of that. You know, one of the things that they changed that was really drastic that Rian Johnson had a pretty heavy hand in was the murder scenes. So when Blank, the punk, when he gets murdered, there's a lot of kind of fractured editing, a lot of kind of jumping back and forth in time and place. And it kind of gives a feeling of losing control, of being out of place and out of time. And instead they kind of had just had it be like a really straightforward thing. And yet it just wasn't working. It didn't give them the kind of psychological effect that they wanted at first. And then when they did that, they had to change Adam's death. He said, quote, "We did this after editing the film together. Originally, you didn't see Adam's death, but we decided to do the same thing with Blank's death, jumping back in time. Mm-hmm. And we did a patchwork of a bunch of songs established throughout the film, much like what May does making her doll," end quote. So then it changed the way they had to reshoot how Adam was killed, and to have it on screen and to be more, a part of it, just like what they did with Blank's death. And I love the thing that they did with the music too, that they did a patchwork of music with everything kind of culminating together. It's a patchwork process. You see patchwork in costumes, you see patchwork in production design, you hear patchwork in the music.
I love that story because I always get into post, and if it isn't working, I'm like, I have failed. I'm a failed filmmaker. I should quit. I hate my life. My first movie I edited for 8 months because I decided that it was trash, and I kept re-editing and redoing it. I was insane about it. I just like had so much trouble getting it to where I needed to be, and it made me feel like post makes me feel like a failure because the whole time I'm like, oh my gosh, did I completely screw this up? But then you realize once you find an editor that really can do something or can have a different vision, that you didn't screw it up. You can just make kind of a different thing out of it. So it's nice to hear that he went through that many editors to make this awesome movie.
So something we should talk about are the cats in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Many of them are dead.
Yeah.
This is maybe one of my favorite parts of the commentary. And the whole time I was just like, is this story true? I can't tell if this is true. But they said, quote, "The dead cats came from Mr. Deeds. On a movie with an actual budget, they'll get the cat they're going to use and then make the fake version of it. But with ours, we had the fake one first, and we had to find cats to match one of six options. The fake cat had some weird zany smile on its face, so we actually had to smash it and put blood all over it."
Wait, Mr. Deeds, the Adam Sandler movie? Is that Mr. Deeds?
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole time I was just like, I mean, like, it's totally possible that this came from like the Mr. Deeds set. Like, I'm not saying that it's not. I'm just saying it's.
Wow, that is crazy. But also good indie filmmaking move. Like, do it that way. Yeah.
And the cat was the production designer's cat, the live one. So they had that taken care of. They shot a bunch of stuff in their own homes.
Yeah.
And then in a building downtown that they got for free. We'll talk about that later on. But when it comes to kind of blood and gore and fake parts and things, you like 12-hour shift has
we have
some
a lot,
stuff.
Yeah, we have some stuff happening in it. We definitely have some stuff.
I mean, it can get expensive. How do you, you know, decide what you're going to show? How do you get that kind of stuff? Can you borrow it? Like, what do you...
No, yeah. Well, one way you save money is that you don't have a special effects person. That's what we did. Because we low-budget movie. Like, we kind of had to just do it all ourselves. But we had a makeup artist who, you know, could do some gore effects. And my production designer, the one thing we did... make sure we could get was the organs. There's a, you know, because there it's all about stealing organs and taking people's organs. Yep. So those are like fake organs, but the actual ones they would be like in there, because we knew if those looked fake, the movie wouldn't work. So she was really specific about finding those. But everything else is kind of just done with, you know, fake blood effects and squirts. There's, you know, definitely moments where we were blowing through straws and, you know, putting blood in there and blowing through straws at people. My producer did that one day. So, yeah, I mean, you know, you kind of do it the best way you know how in that moment.
I mean, yeah, I get it. That's the... God, blood. I mean, that's everyone's favorite part of playing on a set, though, I think. So there's that.
These days, it's not that expensive, too. You can, like, buy good fake blood for not crazy amounts. So it's something that you can buy quite a bit of and make sure you're covered.
Like I said, the Lucky ended up getting that location where the vet's office is. It's a free building. It's the building that's adjacent downtown Los Angeles to the Bank of America over by... like a block away from Walt Disney Concert Hall. I don't know if it's still empty. I don't know if they put anything in there, but at the time, you know, it was just like owned by the city and they were able to get in there for free. And then they kind of like it had walls. And so they just kind of built an office into it and it was theirs to use for anything. So they ended up using it for a few things because it was free. And the movie maybe might not have gotten made if they didn't have like all these free locations, because that's a huge part of the budget sometimes. But I thought that was wonderful. Like, they couldn't find an office, so they ended up making one.
Yeah, that's great. And, like, kudos to their production designer, because that must have been such a lot of work to dress it, to make it look like an office. Because it really does. Like, they have files and, you know, all the stuff that makes you feel like it's an office. But I do wonder also if it's like what you said earlier, where they knew they were only going to shoot these one directions, so they made sure that those walls were full of files and those walls had the computers and whatever on them.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she said the production designer said that she ran around collecting files from every other room that was in this building to try to fill it.
Yeah. I'm familiar with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's something that's, it's tough when you write to a location that you don't have yet, you can kind of write yourself into a trap because, you know, for instance, you're in a hospital, like you need a hospital. Did you get your hospital first? Did you like...
No.
I mean, like, you're writing something that has to have a hospital.
Yeah, yeah. I thought this movie would never get made for that reason. It was definitely a big choice because it's 95% of the movie takes place within this hospital. No, my producers read the script. They wanted to make it. And one of the reasons they thought they could make it is because one of their dads knew that a hospital in Arkansas where he lived was about to redo a floor. And it was completely empty. And they just went up there and were like, can we shoot a movie on this floor of your hospital before you redo it? And they're like, oh, we're going to redo it next month. And they're like, can you wait a month? Because right now it looks very 90s and we would like to use it. This film is set in the 90s. And they're like, we can wait a month because it's like small town Arkansas. Like they're just nice people and they want to help out. So we ended up having an entire floor of a hospital, which is sort of the indie film dream because we could have offices. We could have rooms for our actors. They were all in like hospital rooms to themselves. And then we shot in the main, one of the main hallways and then in like the waiting room and stuff like that. But yeah, it was just, we got really lucky, but also my producers were just great about finding this space. And I think if we hadn't found that space, I'm not sure we would have been able to make, we wouldn't have been able to make the movie because you couldn't dress it. Dressing it was tough though. We had to go and get a bunch of stuff from old offices. And then the hospital also happened to have a big building in the back where they kept all their old nursing equipment, and they let us go and like raid that and fill it up. But it was hard to actually to kind of fill up all of the space. Like a lot of the stuff in the movie is reused and like moved from location to location. But yeah, our production designer just did an amazing job, and our producers did an amazing job of finding the space and then finding all this equipment on top of that.
The one thing that I'll leave off is something that everyone who was on the commentary was really happy about, the fact that Lucky McKee was a very hands-on director, not just when the camera was rolling, but just after everything was wrapped. They said, quote, "The cigarette thing, just like I said, nobody was getting paid. They were doing this out of the kindness of their hearts and love of the project, and it makes a difference to have smokes when they get there. They have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to work on your movie. You should just do whatever little things you can do to know they're appreciated. I made a couple beer runs too." So every morning he would go and get cigarettes and have them, because you know, it's like early 2000s,
right?
Like
people smoke.
Everyone's still smoking. Yeah. I was still smoking. So you just like go and have all of these cigarettes ready for people. And then afterwards would also go and get beer if necessary. But then, you know, production design and cinematography, they were saying Lucky showed up at wrap. He put away equipment, helped us pull furniture out of locations. I don't think I've ever experienced that before with a director, end quote. And I think that makes a difference on a low budget set.
Yeah, it definitely does. And it helps you to bond, I think, a little bit, you know, if you're just all hanging out and you see that the director is trying to do something a little bit more. I will say on 12-hour shift, David Arquette brought a donkey to set one day, and people really were excited about that. That was a really big favor.
That is such a morale booster.
It was
just
such
like,
a
oh my God,
booster.
Here's a donkey.
Literally just for us to take photos with and hang out with. That was all it was there for. It was amazing. It was super amazing. And I will say this about Angela. Like she's a, I don't know if she'd be embarrassed if I say this. She would. But she, our last day of shooting 12-hour shift, we wrapped and then we had to wrap out the location the whole night. And then I got on a plane the next morning to go to Tribeca because After Midnight was premiering at Tribeca last year. And Angela stayed up all night with the crew and helped everybody pack up the location, which was this crazy thing where we were like, can we let the lead actress like help pack stuff up? And she was like, I really want to help. She was really close to the crew. And so she stayed and helped all night long. It was so amazing.
Oh my God.
I know.
Wow. Okay. So, I mean, if you got through this episode and you don't already love Angela Bettis, maybe check out Bria's movie 12-Hour Shift and take a look. Can you give us a rundown of when and how we can see your movies?
Yeah. You can see 12-Hour Shift starting October 2nd on all VOD platforms, and then it is playing some theaters. It's playing, I don't know when this comes out, but it's playing in Los Angeles, Torrance, which is kind of Los Angeles, on October 1st at a drive-in. I think it's playing other drive-ins in the United States, but I don't know where. And then Lucky actually doesn't come out till next year, but it's going to be on Shudder next year. And also, I'll just plug, I wrote a graphic novel, which is coming out October 4th, and it's called Mary. If you would like to check that out, you can get it at every bookstore, everywhere on the internet. But I like to suggest a place called bookshop.org because they you can order it online, but it part of the money goes to your local bookstore.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for coming on the show again. It's great to have you back.
Thank you for having me. I feel like I learned so much this episode. It's been very informative.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.